We know with this technology that there are manifold risks involved with using it.
China gets pushback for gene editing human embryos. It's Friday, November 30th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, easing tensions between India and Pakistan, Australia's love affair with alcohol, and artificial intelligence, help or threat? It's all on today's VOA Asia. Scientists at the second International Summit on Human Genome Editing meeting in Hong Kong issued a statement Thursday denouncing a Chinese scientist's claim to have altered the embryonic genes of twin girls born this month as irresponsible. It is the first known instance of so-called gene editing, and conference leaders called for an independent investigation. The scientist in question, He Jingguai, an associate professor at Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, addressed the conference on Wednesday and apologized that the result of his work was leaked unexpectedly. But he defended his use of the CRISPR-Cas9 technology to help the twin girls resist possible future infection with HIV, the virus which causes AIDS.
For this specific case, I feel proud, actually. I feel proudest because the Mark thought he lost the hope for the life. But when the baby was born and with his protection, he sent a message at the day of birth, say, I will work hard, our money, and take care of his two daughters and his wife for his second half life.
He's referring there to the father of the girls. He pledged to cooperate with all inquiries, making new his raw data available for third-party review. There has been no independent confirmation of He's work. Chinese scientists have also condemned the work. His university, the Guangdong Health Commission, and Shenzhen City authorities have launched an investigation. Christopher Scott is a professor of health policy and bioethics at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He told VOA's Victor Beatty what he knows from what he has learned and read, what he has read concerns him.
And the concern is primarily based on the fact that we know with this technology that there are manifold risks involved with using it, some of which have been actually identified in the experiment that he revealed in Hong Kong, and that those risks, which include off-target effects where the gene is being integrated in unintended areas of the DNA, another phenomenon called chimerism or mosaicism, where there are some cells that are edited and some aren't, and then simple mutations, the process itself is not 100% efficient. And so a report several months ago by scientists in a leading journal revealed that even the editing process itself, which is very precise in many ways, is not foolproof. And so these collection of things that science is working through have not, in my view, been validated to the point where we can reasonably say that an experiment like this is not without substantial risk. And the bottom line for this, to me, is that this is a case, a rather troubling case of unethical human experimentation.
He defends his work, which he claims is self-funded, to protect these girls, these twin girls, from the infection with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Is that justification, in your view, to do such a thing?
It's not clear to me what exactly the medical need is for this experiment. So I've heard two stories. One, the fathers are HIV positive, that engineering the embryos in this manner somehow protects the embryos in the IVF procedure itself from infection. Well, we know that there are other ways of doing that without actually engineering the embryos. There's also a rationale for having these children be immune to HIV infection. So that's actually an aim of the study. And in my mind, there are other ways to protect individuals from HIV infection without undergoing the rather significant risks of a gene editing procedure. This is one of these technologies that has tremendous potential. The problem for me is that this research is still very, very young. I mean, we're only talking about 2012 with such a short timeline to truly understand the impacts of the technology on the genome. So these children, apparently, genetic changes that are not only in their genome, but they are in their germ cells, too. So when they have children, those changes will be passed on. This is really a monumental concern because the children, according to the researcher, will be followed for 18 years only. But these are lifetime and generation sort of changes.
Christopher Scott said a question that science and ethics must now struggle with is how to understand risk when it goes beyond just a procedure to encompass a person's lifetime and that of his ancestors. He said there is firm international consensus that such experiments are simply not ready for use. The research must continue and that scientists must not act on their own. He said there should be an open and thorough debate about its future use. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. South Korea's top court ruled that Japan's Mitsubishi Heavy Industries must compensate South Koreans for forced labor during the Second World War. Police in India have put on hold efforts to retrieve the body of an American missionary who was killed by a secluded tribe on an island off the Indian mainland. Congressman Chris Smith is calling on President Donald Trump to raise the issue of China's mass internment of Muslim ethnic minorities with Xi Jinping. And a Sri Lankan court ordered the detention of the country's top military officer in connection with the abduction and disappearance of 11 young people. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And VOA Asia continues. India and Pakistan, two nuclear-armed rivals in South Asia, with a famously tumultuous relationship and several wars in their past, have decided to put aside their antagonism to help the Sikh community commemorate the 550th birth anniversary of Sikhism's founder next year. The nations are creating a new fenced corridor from an Indian border city to a Sikh holy site inside Pakistan to make it easier for pilgrims to visit. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
This temple, the final resting place of Sikhism's founder, is only 4 kilometers from India's border. But the lack of a border crossing means thousands of Sikh pilgrims have to take a long route, first to the Pakistani border city Lahore, and then a 3 to 4 hour journey from there to get here. Or they have to contend with a distant glimpse from a viewing stage across the border.
On the other side, they have binoculars installed. So pilgrims who come there, they see the Gurdwara and pay their obeisance through the binoculars.
But next year, before the 550th birth anniversary of Sikh founder Guru Nanak, the governments of India and Pakistan have promised to open a new border crossing. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan laid the foundation stone Wednesday on the Pakistani side.
According to the plan, Indian pilgrims will arrive at a border terminal complex to receive special permits for visa-free entry for the holy shrine. Special buses from the terminal complex will take them to the shrine and back along the 4-kilometer fenced corridor.
The gesture is raising hopes the two sides, who are going through a downturn in their roller coaster relationship, will use access to the shrine as an impetus to turn their relationship around. But analysts caution against high expectations.
We're seeing opportunities created for engagement, but I don't think that the Kartarpur corridor, which is essentially a faith corridor, can become something larger unless there is a political will for that.
In his address at the ceremony, Khan said the two nuclear-armed neighbors have no choice but peace. At the same time, he pointed to Kashmir as a main dispute that needs to be resolved. Meanwhile, Indian politicians have hailed the opening of the corridor, but continue to accuse Pakistan of supporting terrorism on Indian soil. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Kartarpur, Pakistan.
Happening now in Asia, Asian markets traded mostly higher Thursday ahead of a crucial meeting between President Donald Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping, which many are hoping would help ease trade tensions between the U.S. and China. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Google is almost done with its first ever indie game accelerator program. 32 startups from around Asia are attending an all-expenses-paid boot camp where they're learning about game development, business development, and office management. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. World leaders are preparing for a potentially fiery G20 summit starting Friday in Buenos Aires. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the two-day meeting is being held against the backdrop of a spiraling trade war that has set the global economy on edge, plus a series of dangerous security flashpoints from Ukraine to the Middle East to the South China Sea.
The scene is set for a fractious summit as the leaders of the world's two biggest economies come together in the midst of a trade war. US President Donald Trump has threatened to raise tariffs from 10% to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. He has warned of more tariffs if no agreement is reached with Beijing on issues like trade imbalances and intellectual property. The White House believes it holds the momentum for a possible deal.
Most observers believe China to be in a slump, whereas the United States is in a very strong, solid position going into this summit.
China has warned of grave consequences if the trade war intensifies.
In the last century, we had two world wars, and in between them, Great Depression. I don't think anybody should really try to have a repetition of history.
The first G20 leaders summit was held following the 2008 global financial crisis.
Now a decade on, the greatest threat to established economic order is actually surprisingly coming from, in many ways, the chief defender of that order with the protectionist trade wars kicked off by President Trump and the America First foreign policy.
Geopolitical tensions are simmering. The meeting comes days after Russia rammed Ukrainian vessels off Crimea and seized several of its naval personnel. Kiev says the incident happened in international waters. In response, US President Donald Trump raised doubts about a planned meeting at the summit with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Speaking Wednesday, Putin blamed Ukraine.
What was the Russian border control force supposed to do? Military ships have illegally entered into the territorial waters of Russian Federation.
Also attending the summit, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, implicated in ordering the killing last month of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul, and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It is vital the summit is seen to make progress on key global challenges, says Naylor.
Well, how ought the economic system operate? Is protectionism a good thing or a bad thing? Is climate change real or not? If these countries can't agree, it sends a very, very strong signal to everybody not at the table that maybe they don't need to sign up.
Thousands of anti-globalization protesters are already gathering in Buenos Aires. 22,000 police officers are being deployed in the capital, while some of the fiercest battles could take place inside the summit itself. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Taliban attacks have killed at least 30 security personnel, while dozens of police officers have been injured in clashes with angry protesters in western Kabul, according to Afghan officials. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Australia's love affair with drinking is waning, according to official figures that show alcohol consumption has fallen to levels not seen since the early 1960s. The decline has been led by a fall in beer sales and by a cultural shift against alcohol by younger people. The Australian Bureau of Statistics estimates a fifth of the population now are teetotalers. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Alcohol consumption in fun-loving Australia is at its lowest in more than 55 years. Beer, wine and spirits are still a big part of life here, but in a land with a boozy reputation, it's health-conscious young people who are drinking less. Professor Ian Hickey, who's in his 50s, of the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney, says there's been a cultural shift away from drinking.
I think it's really interesting. I think we have turned a significant corner. There's some interesting changes in alcohol consumption in Australia, particularly amongst young people. So a decade ago, 15 years ago, we had a major upswing in binge drinking and alcohol-related harm in younger populations, particularly under the age of 25, really major problems. Over the last decade, we've progressively seen less binge drinking, less actually persistent alcohol-related risk amongst younger people. Sadly, people of my age have continued on largely with their behaviour that they've had.
Australia's tastes are changing. Small craft brewers say that beer made with native ingredients is becoming more popular as drinkers choose quality over quantity. Kerry Abbott, co-owner of the Nomad Brewing Company in Sydney, is seeing a more mature approach to alcohol consumption.
What we're seeing is people drinking less, but drinking better. So instead of taking their $30 into a pub and saying, I want to get as many beers as I can out of this, they're actually saying, I want to have the best experience that I can. So I'm going to go in and I might only get two beers out of this, but I'm going to have an experience. I'm going to taste something. I'm going to hear a story. I'm going to be transported by this beer rather than just, I'm just going to guzzle a beer and have no experience at all.
For many Australians, drinking is a national pastime, especially on days when there are major sporting events. Alcohol is widely available and relatively cheap. For most, it's just a bit of fun, a social lubricant that helps them to relax. But for others, alcohol has a darker side. Jessica Kachan has been sober for 5 years. The Sydney mother says that her addiction to alcohol was so bad, she thought she would die.
I just needed alcohol to make me feel good, give me that confidence, allow me to get out of bed or whatever. I was a functioning alcoholic, I guess, for a long time. But yet the thing that was keeping me going was killing me. So, and it was my family that noticed, you know, that something's not right here. And just not wanting to live anymore. So recovery's really given me a new gift of life and just the opportunity to be that mum and that person I'm meant to be.
Regularly drinking too much increases your risk of developing many serious illnesses, including cancer. Your risk of illness can increase with the amount of alcohol.
Alcohol is Australia's most lethal drug. It kills more people each year than all illicit substances combined. For some, it's a demon that's hard to overcome. The Reverend Bill Cruz, who organises an annual march for those recovering from substance abuse, says if the law took a uniform approach to all drugs in Australia, the impact would be immense.
What we need to have is a consistent government approach to every drug. So you kind of tighten up a bit on alcohol, loosen up, decriminalise other things, treat them all as health issues, and then you'll get somewhere. All that money that goes into the criminal syndicates would go into rehab and people would get help. Because the drug industry, the illicit drug industry and the alcohol industry needs abuse to survive so that they would be applauding the fact there are so many addicts because that's where they get all the profit from.
The Australian government recommends no more than two standard drinks per day. A bottle of wine contains around 7 units. That plea for moderation appears to be working. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Artificial intelligence is no longer futuristic science fiction. It's a very real part of our daily lives. This week's Plugged In, that airs here on VOA, gives us a look at how computer-based intelligence is shaping our lives and how it's likely to change our future. VOA's Jesusima Oni has more.
Artificial intelligence has transformed the way many of us live. It affects how we travel, what we browse, even what we eat. But the rapidly evolving technology raises a host of fundamental questions, says Microsoft's chief legal officer, Brad Smith.
Just as no person and no government and no company should be above the law, no technology should be above the law either. We're going to have to create ethical principles and ultimately laws so that societies can decide how they want this technology to be used.
With algorithms that threaten to surpass levels of human intelligence, artificial intelligence has been deployed in the fight against terrorism, global hunger, and in the medical arena.
A lot of the most recent advances in immunotherapy, for example, in the world of cancer treatment, actually are already building on artificial intelligence, and there's every reason to believe that that is going to continue and accelerate.
But advances in AI could also mean a transformed job market, one much harder for low-skilled workers to enter.
If you go through a drive-thru for a fast food restaurant, you basically have a human being, an employee, who's just listening to what you say into a microphone and entering your order into a computer. I would think that in 5 years, there's a very good chance that that person isn't going to have that job, that is going to be done by a computer who can understand perfectly well what you're saying and enter it in.
Smith adds, it's fundamental for today's workforce to learn new skills in order to advance in the new era. Jason Semelny, VOA News, Washington.
Finally today, several Democratic women, including Senators Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Kirsten Gillibrand, are potential presidential contenders in 2020. But it could be more of an uphill battle for them than their male counterparts. That's because just over half Americans are totally comfortable with the idea of a woman being president, according to a new report by the consulting firm Cantor Public. The report finds that while 63% of Americans are perfectly fine with the idea of a woman heading a major corporation, just 52% are as comfortable with the scenario featuring a female president. Men apparently are more inclined to judge a person's leadership suitability based on gender. Can anyone say Angela Merkel? Well, that's VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure. We will be with you again on Monday. Hope you will join us then as well. And until then, have a great weekend.